The story I'm about to tell you is not a baseball story, but it is an infinite inning story. And by that I mean, for those of you who have not heard me talk about our animating metaphor here, the infinite inning is that place in life where, try as you might, have the best intentions you can muster, put everything you can on the ball, you cannot get the third out. There is no escape. Having said that, having admitted that the infinite inning exists, I think that envy and bitterness are among the most wasted of human emotions. I disinclude hate. I'd like to talk about hate another time, and I don't mean political hate or race hate or any of those other primitive emotions, but things where people have really wronged you and you don't let it go. I think about that a lot, because there's this cliche, hating somebody is letting them live in your brain rent-free, and it bugs me, because maybe I'm okay with that. Maybe I'm okay with letting someone live in my brain rent-free, because it's not yet time for me to kick them out, and only I can say when that time will be. But anyway, this isn't that story. I was talking about envy and bitterness, and the feelings that get you when you see someone else succeed, and you haven't achieved what you want to achieve in life. I feel like I may have quoted the following to you before in one of the foregoing 40 episodes, and if so, forgive me. But I guess there are subjects that, like all of you, I'm working my way through on a recurrent basis. Gore Vidal, who's kind of a bastard but one of my favorite authors, once said that when a friend succeeds, a little part of me dies. I don't feel that way. I think I am sincerely happy for my friends when they do well. At the same time, we all in our lives have moments where we say, well, why didn't that happen for me? Why doesn't the world love me and want me and desire me as much as Bob? Why is Bob making the big salary? Why does Bob live in the big house with the cool car? And I don't want to get into our hypothetical Bob here and whether Bob is more or less skilled than we are, or is better at networking or backstabbing for that matter than we are, or any other quality of Bob. Because in the end, Bob's life is Bob's life and it has not a damn thing to do with us. And we cannot begrudge Bob his success. We can only try to create our own. Casey Stengel said that people make their own luck, that some people will have bad luck all their lives. I think about that a lot because it's true. I do believe that when you have the thing, the skill, the talent, the product, the means of escape, the key out of the infinite inning, that the world will beat a path to your door for your better mousetrap. I don't know when that will be. And the infinite inningness of it all may be that some of us don't have the talent or the skill or the ability to network or to backstab or, hell, to succeed on a completely ethical basis. And Bob may succeed on a completely ethical basis. Again, Bob is hypothetical. I'm not drawing a portrait of anybody. Any similarities between Bob here and a person in your life or mine are purely coincidental. I swear to this on a stack of baseball encyclopedias. I even swear to it on a stack of great brain books, which may have had as much influence on my life as Bill James did. Not necessarily a good influence. What I'm trying to say in my own awkward and limited way is that envy is a waste of time and energy when you could invest the same energy in hope. But then again, there's this story. Again, it's not a baseball story. But it is a gift of baseball because I found it in the June 3rd, 1948 Oakland Tribune, and I was looking for some Pacific Coast League story. I don't even know what at this stage. The Oakland Oaks won the pennant that year, and it was a Casey Stengel team, but I've been done with that research for a long time. Anyway, I was looking at that quite recently. It doesn't even have anything to do with Oakland. It's set in Maine, East New Portland, Maine, as a matter of fact. It's just an AP story they happened to publish, but I read it, and I felt crushed for the protagonist. The newspaper story thinks the protagonist is one person. I think it's another. I think you'll agree with me. It's very brief. I'm just going to read it to you. Headline, Man and Turtle, 20 Years of Friendship. East New Portland, Maine, June 3rd, Associated Press. Harold E. Atwood and his jackknife have a date in 1958 with an old acquaintance. A turtle first encountered 20 years ago. In the spring of 1928, Atwood and a companion carved their initials and the date on a turtle they found in Weymouth Brook. 10 years later, Atwood found the same shellback plodding around George Eford's farm 2 miles from the brook. he carved 38 and once more released his old friend. Recently, Atwood had another encounter with Mr. Turtle at Newell Brook, 2 miles farther from Weymouth Brook. If the itinerant recognized Atwood, it probably knew what to expect and got it. 1948. Imagine yourself in this poor animal's position. He's fortunate to be alive, but nevertheless he's been assaulted. Working against him is the fact that he moves very slowly. Working in his favor is the fact that he's very long-lived. And so, having been caught once and disfigured by an ape child, he can calculate a plan of escape. And over 10 years, he moves 2 miles, 2 grueling miles away from the spot at which he was captured. Unfortunately, while to a turtle 2 miles may be equivalent to our 1,000 miles, it doesn't work the other way around. So he's captured again, and again has to endure the pain, or if not the pain, the humiliation of having himself scarred, marked as if he were a tree, by this same jerk. And so the turtle thinks, I see the flaw in my plan. I didn't go far enough. So he doubles the distance. He moves another 2 miles. Again, the same as us, walking 1,000 miles on foot. And it doesn't work. He's captured again. He's disfigured again. It's been 20 years, and he cannot get away. Here he is, lifted in the air again, that strange weightless feeling. And he rolls one small eye slowly upwards, just in time to see the midday sun flash brilliantly off the side of the knife as it descends slowly downwards towards his shell. There's an early Stephen King story called Sometimes They Come Back. You might have heard of it. It was turned into a series of B-movies at one point. I haven't seen those, and I have no desire to, because I really dislike this story. And I dislike it because it's so effective. I mean, up to a point. The ending kind of peters out, and I think later in his career, when he was even more pessimistic, he would have put a darker end on what is already a very dark story. The story imagines a really perfect nightmare, and it's this. We all had moments in our childhood when we were helpless at the hands of others, bullies or the neighborhood psychopath. There was one in my school that they kept trying to mainstream, even though he kept hurting the other children. And up through about 5th grade, they would bring him back and say, no, really, he's much better now. And if we had had the vocabulary at that age to say, hey, Mrs. Guidance Counselor, you're doing something really irresponsible right now, because unless you're willing to vouch to all of us 11-year-olds that Brad there is on some heavy antipsychotic medications that are going to have him pretty much comatose throughout today's lesson, we are not going to be learning anything, the rest of us 11-year-olds, because we will be too busy trying to stop him from biting us. And here's the scary thing about Brad. Sometimes I wouldn't encounter him in the relatively safe environment of the classroom where there were others to restrain him. I might encounter him walking home. And in moments like that, I knew how Little Red Riding Hood felt encountering the wolf. And no, the story does not function as a sexual metaphor in this telling, thank you. King tells a story about a man who was physically and emotionally brutalized by teen criminals when he was a kid. 20 years later, he's an English teacher, and the same kids reappear in his classroom, except they're still the age they were, and they're bent on finishing the job they began years earlier. And of course, it's not a realistic story, but at the same time, it seems so plausible that the helplessness we felt then might return for us. And though we pretend that we're adults now, that we are secure in our ability to defend ourselves, to rise to the occasion, and of course that in our civilized adult world, adults do not behave towards one another as kitty predators do to their prey. But it's not impossible. Childhood trauma, because of the way time dilates for a kid, really can be the most infinite of innings. The idea that we could get sucked back to that place is terrifying. That turtle from 1948, for all I know, he's still around. That's what he was living through. And so, although I began this little talk by saying that one should let go of one's bitterness and resentment and embrace hope, there's also this other truth that sometimes they come back, that this low moment will recur, and that the author of our miseries will reappear once again with his pocket knife to sign a bloody autograph on our backs. Will you maintain hope then, when we learn that we are not adults, that we are not free agents, that we are nothing more than turtles in the hands of an angry god? I'm Stephen Goldman, and this is the Infinite Inning Baseball Podcast. Talking cat in the Kelly Green outfit says, "Your Highness, I bring word from General Morello of the Arboreal Tribe. They are holding out against the Grey Legions, but their situation is desperate. If Castle Defiance falls, we are all in for chocolate terror at the hands of Lady Grimstaff and the Feldspar Knight. Will you help us, Your Highness?" And you say, "Your Highness, no, I'm Your Hairiness, Harry Bish. I'm an accountant with the Consolidated Waste Disposal, and you are interrupting my audit of episode 41. But tell me, can you sing? Because we're going to make a lot of money together." Welcome back to the show. You may notice we're a bit late this week. This week is going to be a bit of a doubleheader as a result. The episode that I had intended for Friday is now going up on a Monday. You should be listening to it on a Monday, assuming you have pounced. I hope you're enthusiastic enough to pounce, and if not, you're going to be very confused later when a second episode shows up on Friday, as we get back on our normal, just barely scraping by and avoiding falling into the weekend schedule, which is all on me. It's my fault, and in this case, I had a guest reschedule at the last moment, and it took me a little while to recover from that, and it's only by virtue of my great friend Ben Lindbergh, who stepped in at the very last minute when at first he didn't think he'd be able to, that we have an episode with a guest at all this week, or it's not me interviewing my cat, because it was looking pretty dark for a while there. But as a result of all that, as a result of the delays encountered therefrom, we did slip past the weekend. And for that, I apologize. Be aware that the Cubs signed Yu Darvish after we had this conversation, so we were not able to discuss it. We were more focused on what is now the traditional bemoaning of the absence of moves. Well, now we have had that one move, and I think it was a good one, something that the Cubs needed to do, but there are still so many more to go. This thought isn't really connected to anything, but that talk about looking things up in the Oakland Tribune before got me thinking about a catcher named Johnny Bassler. And I don't have a long story to tell you about Johnny Bassler. I don't know a ton about Johnny Bassler, except that Johnny Bassler was really cool, and I wish he were around today. You know, in the first edition of Bill James' Historical Baseball Abstract, the very first version, he had player comps for some of the old-timers. And these weren't the kind that are generated via Pacoda or Zips or any of those things. These were just kind of impressionistic. Basically, what did those guys seem like to Bill James? And very memorably, under Yogi Berra, he wrote that Yogi Berra was kind of a combination of Gary Carter and a dwarf. And I think that's about right. The funny thing about that is, you know, that book was 30-some years ago, and Gary Carter was an active and living, unfortunately, he's no longer with us, ballplayer at that time, and so the comparison would have resonated with people. Now people would be saying, wait, you're comparing someone we never saw to someone we never saw. Johnny Bassler's a little different, because when you're comparing Carter and Berra, you're comparing a Hall of Famer to a Hall of Famer. I'm going to compare two guys who are not, but I would say that Johnny Bassler was kind of a combination of John Jaso and a dwarf. Bassler played over 800 games in the major leagues, mostly for the Tigers. He was only 5'9", left-handed swinger, and he was a good hitter in his way. He had a 304 career lifetime average, and yeah, the 20s were a high average time, but not everybody hit 304, and certainly not everyone had a 416 career on base percentage, because Bassler added to that batting average by just walking a ton proportionately to his playing time. The problem, I think, and I don't know what his glove was like, but offensively, the problem was he was almost incapable of hitting a home run. He hit a grand total of one in those 811 major league games he played. And so when you look at him on Baseball Reference or in the encyclopedia, you see that his career slugging percentage was only 361. And in the Pacific Coast League, where he played forever, both before and after his time in the majors, he hit only five more home runs. He played mostly for the Hollywood Stars in the 20s and 30s after the majors, and he had a career lifetime average in the Pacific Coast League of 321. He was still good enough to play until he was 42, and his career didn't end for lack of playing ability so much as the fact that he had an actual heart attack. He was so well thought of as a player, in fact, that he was part of the inaugural class of the Pacific Coast League Hall of Fame in 1943, even though his lifetime slugging percentage in the minors was 381. Don't take that as me belittling him at all, though. Consider him at his major league best. 1922, he hits 322 with a 422 on base, 360 slugging, 14 doubles, no triples, no home runs. Finishes sixth in the MVP voting. Next year, 298, 414, 345. Somehow hit three triples. People must have fallen down. Finished seventh in the MVP voting. And then in 1924, his best season, played 124 games, hit 346 with a 441 on base, 422 slugging, because he added that one home run. Finished fifth in the MVP voting. Parenthetically, the one home run came at Yankee Stadium off a very good pitcher, the right-hander Sailor Bob Shockey, four-time 20 game winner. But Babe Ruth also homered in the game, so probably nobody noticed what Bassler had done. Anyway, no great import here, except that I like to point out the billboards on the side of the road when I see them, and it's just fun to know about guys like this, and to think about what they might have accomplished had their major league careers been a little longer. But you could do really well in the PCL in those days. Make more money and play before more fans than you could in the majors. Before I bring Ben onto the stage, a listener asked me to comment on some news from the past week, which was that Jim Tomei announced that he would prefer that his Hall of Fame plaque have the Indians block C on it rather than the Chief Wahoo logo. This seems utterly uncontroversial to me, and praiseworthy on Tomei's part, because Chief Wahoo has long been an abomination, and I'm glad that going forward, the Indians will largely be scrapping it, except to maintain some sales of the logo so that they can keep the trademark. I've written about this issue before. I don't know where, I don't know when, and sometimes I even write up pieces on things that I end up scrapping for one reason or another, but if any of this sounds familiar to you or you've read it before, forgive me. My thinking is my thinking, I guess. And although hopefully my thinking in many areas evolves over time, in other ways I tend to conceive things in the same way. And this is one where I haven't changed. We could talk about this for a very long time. There's a lot of ink that has been spilled on this issue, and it's a hard issue to get to the bottom of because it requires a certain empathy and a certain understanding that even if a large number of people look at an image and see it as harmless, that if one person of the group being depicted sees it and feels demeaned by it, then that is one person too many. And even here there are complexities. People choose to get offended by all kinds of stuff, some of which many of us might call art, but this isn't necessarily art. This is a caricature on a baseball cap of a specific ethnic group. And so you can't make the same arguments about this, pro or con, that you would make about, say, a Robert Mapplethorpe picture. One of Mapplethorpe's sexualized photographs might scandalize you in terms of what is permissible to view in public, but he's not calling out an entire racial group. Wahoo does, even if some people look at it and just see a cartoon. And so if you're a Wahoo proponent, you have to be able to get past that first initial reaction. What? It's just a picture. You can draw me. I don't mind if you draw me. But of course, they're not drawing, quote unquote, you. They're drawing an entire racial group, and the team is named after the entire racial group, albeit the dumbass name that Christopher Columbus dropped on them, or dropped on the initial group of them that he ran into before he arranged to kill them all. Bring me your gold. We have no gold, senor. Then I will cut off your hands. Shunk. Now bring me your gold. Anyway, it's impossible to grapple with all of the Chief Wahoo arguments that come up without being here another year, but I will mention that two arguments made by proponents of Chief Wahoo bother the hell out of me because they're boneheaded on the surface. One is, it's traditional. Well, great, it's a tradition that's like 80-something years old. It's one human lifespan. It's not a tradition. Second of all, a tradition is a dumb thing that you've always done that you haven't stopped to think about whether you should still be doing it. Does it still have value? Does it still mean what it meant when it started? Is it still useful? Does it have utility? Does it injure anybody? And as with many traditions, if it doesn't meet those criteria, you throw it out. And for God's sake, it's a baseball cap. If it does injure anybody, you stop, because there are more important things. Second, proponents of the logo are always saying, we've conducted a survey of many people who identify as Native American, and they say that they are not bothered by Chief Wahoo at all. Well, great. Good for you. Glad you paid for a survey. I'm glad you found some people who are tough enough to say that, darn it, they're not offended by the cartoon. It doesn't matter. You don't need other people to tell you what's right and wrong. And you know, unless you are a brain-dead idiot, that throughout time, we caricature people we want to make fun of. Were this a visual medium, I would now whip out some political cartoons from after the Civil War that would curl your hair. They are so rancid with racist imagery and racist dialogue. And the targets in them? African Americans? Irish Americans? Native Americans? Asian Americans? Catholic Americans? All of them are drawn in a way to be exaggerated in their features, exaggerated in their habits. Any perceived negatives are exaggerated, and inevitably, the point of the depiction is to reassure the reader, who I assume in 99.9% of cases was a white Protestant American, that the races depicted were in some way inferior or threatening or so hopelessly primitive that they're beneath contempt. It is said that when Bill Veeck commissioned the logo, he asked for something, and this is a quote, that would convey a spirit of pure joy and unbridled enthusiasm. And again, great. I'm glad that was the intention. And the character might even be defensible on that basis had the Cleveland team invested in creating a character that had depth and nuance and humanity, and not just created a nameless quote-unquote Indian wearing a shit-eating grin who represents all quote-unquote Indians on a team named the Indians. It's so generic that it becomes specific. It seems astounding that a people, a race, that was on this continent before us, that we negotiated with and embraced and rejected and fought and cajoled and chased all the way across the bloody continent and up to Canada and down to Mexico in some cases, could become a figure or figures of unbridled joy and enthusiasm in what are apparently Veeck's words. That is a process that happens, I think, inevitably over time with victors and the vanquished. First, your antagonist is a figure of respect, then fear, then anger, and then, once it's all over, people that you can safely laugh at, make mascots of. There's a warning in that. Again, I don't think it's conscious. I just think it happens. In the late 1600s, our Pilgrim forefathers, or their immediate descendants, got involved in something called King Philip's War. And King Philip was not a king of Spain or anything. He was a Native American. He was a chief of the Wampanoag tribe, and his actual name was Metacom or Metacomet. He was the son of Massasoit, who was the chief that famously helped the Pilgrims get through their first harsh winter. The thing is that amity, that first Thanksgiving that we all supposedly celebrate, it didn't last very long. They didn't keep inviting the natives. they were either people to trade with or to be avoided. They were also in decline due to disease that happened to come from said colonists. They were being crowded out because the New England colonies had a crazy high birth rate, and also they fought among themselves. Although Daniel Snyder would have you think of them all as redskins, reductively and disgustingly enough, they identified more with different tribal units that had their own issues of diplomacy and war and reconciliation. And it didn't help that Metacom was apparently not an easy guy to get along with to begin with. He was a little erratic. And without getting into the genesis of the whole thing, what Metacom tried to do was unite all the tribes against the colonists, drive them out. But what he really succeeded in doing is uniting all of New England, because it's not like all the colonies got along either. It's not like all the states get along now. So you get the idea. But he brought them all together in a war against him, and some of the tribes who didn't like him aligned with the New Englanders. The ensuing war lasted 3 years. It was incredibly bloody. A lot of people died on both sides, including Metacom, who was shot dead while hiding in a swamp. You always know a guy's war didn't go well when he ends it by cowering in a swamp or a bunker. That's not quite the same thing as the winner's stand. And here's the thing about that. Metacom was a scary guy, but Metacom had an afterlife. And the afterlife is what concerns us here. He was a frightening man, a deadly threat, until that moment in the swamp. After that moment, though, the New Englanders retrieved his body, removed his head, and they put it on a pole on the gates to Fort Plymouth, where it remained for 20 years. Obviously, Metacom himself was beyond punishment, so the head was meant as a warning. Who was it a warning to? Well, anybody else on the Native American side of the line who might get an idea to try to pick up where Metacom left off. A bit earlier, there was another war between the colonists and the New England tribes. It was called the Pequot War. That really went badly for the Pequots, who were either massacred or sold into Caribbean slavery. And so, as recently as 1900, it was still being debated as to whether or not there were as many as 100 people of Pequot descent left. You probably knew that if you were a Native American hanging around the Massachusetts area in the 1600s. So you looked at Metacom's head, you thought back to your history, and you stayed on your side of the fence. Chief Wahoo is a descendant, not intentionally, but nevertheless is a descendant of Metacom, or specifically, the part of Metacom that spent the first 20 years of his afterlife greeting visitors to Fort Plymouth. The dim echo of his skull that is the Wahoo version of things is reflective of a later generation of Native Americans and the closing of the Indian Wars that occupied the United States from really its founding, but particularly after the Civil War and the explosive growth of railroads through about 1890. Note that Geronimo surrendered for the last time in 1886, and Sitting Bull was murdered in 1890. The Wounded Knee Massacre was that same year. And so, when do the Braves become the Braves? 1912. When do the Indians first become the Indians? 1915. 20 or so years go by, and what once was a partner in conflict was now a figure of pure joy. And if you don't believe that, if you don't believe that that's the psychological process at work, then ask yourself, what would it have meant if someone, some early ball club like the original Cincinnati Reds, had put a Chief Wahoo logo or any Indian logo of any kind, any Native American reference, on their caps or uniforms when the league was founded in 1876? You know what happened that year? Little Bighorn. It would have meant something very, very different, and it would have been in very different taste. Bad taste, in fact, but to the opposite side. I'll leave that here. There's so much more to say. Thousands and thousands of words more to say. But others have said them. They'll keep saying them. Look, it's Jim Tomei's plaque. Mind your damn business. And to borrow from the Hippocratic Oath, for God's sake, do no harm. That's the least that we can do in life. With that, we will take a break for a word or non-word from our sponsors, and then I will be back. Finally, with bashful Ben Lindbergh, savior of this episode. He's mainstay at The Ringer. He is the host of the Effectively Wild podcast at Fangraph. He is one of my favorite writers and just all-around people to talk to. He is my good friend, and in a pinch, he is a lifesaver. I'm happy to have him here again. Welcome, Ben Lindbergh. How are you?
I'm doing well. Happy to be back. And I'm always curious what tale of woe will have preceded me on the episode when I download it, because you never know what the opener will be for one of these guest appearances on the show.
Well, you know, I used to try to be more efficient and mail them, get them done early and mail them to people, but ahead of time, just in case they wanted to comment on them. But no one ever did. And as is sort of habitual in my life, I end up riding the ragged edge of deadline disaster every week anyway. Some combination of procrastinating and researching right until the last minute.
Yeah, well, they always end up well. It's my favorite part of the podcast.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I've often thought about paring down one element or another, but whenever I hint at that, people say, don't. So this is like one of these push me, pull you relationships, me and this podcast.
Yeah.
And it's all your fault, really. And I should thank you for that. I'm not sure if thank you is the right word, but as you we've discussed previously when you've been on this show, I hamleted about doing this podcast for literally, I mean, hundreds of years. And I had done it briefly at Yes, and the technology and the support just weren't there at that time. And I abandoned it. And then I really wanted to get back to it, but I had been so traumatized by that experience that I didn't do it. And it was you who finally said, just go, man, go and do it. And that was great from around June. And that was great from June till the end of the season. And then now I'm saddled with a podcast in which baseball has just gone away.
Yes.
And I was just listening to you discuss this over at Effectively Wild. The same thing, like, oh, thank God we have season previews to do, because otherwise we'd have to actually talk about stuff.
Yeah, it's not easy. Yeah. My other baseball podcast at The Ringer was put on hiatus for the offseason. And initially we were sort of disappointed because we had gone through all the winter last year, and it can be fun. At times you can talk about things that are a little bit off the wall. No one's expecting you to talk about pennant races, so you can just get kind of wacky. So we were sorry not to get the chance to do that. But in retrospect, if you were ever going to put a podcast on hiatus, this would be the time to do so for a baseball podcast. It's been really a relief only to have to do one of them and have to, I mean, otherwise we would have been talking about, I don't know what, the Todd Frazier signing in two different podcasts, and that would have been unpleasant.
This is a bit of an exaggeration, but as I was saying on the last show, I got to be on the MLB Network and attending their pre-production meeting for the Brian Kenny show that I did. They discussed the possibility of many more topics than they actually use, some because they don't know how the time's going to go, and some is just the same process you and I go through of figuring out what would be fun to talk about and what not to talk about. And this is maybe a bit hyperbolic to say that they were like, you know, some of the 5-year cicadas are emerging this year. We could go there.
Yep. Yeah, I've been on a couple times this winter. I was on one day, I guess, back last year, and people were really struggling to come up with anything at the time. I think it was either maybe right before, right after Christmas, right around that holiday period that's always slow, and especially so this year. And I think Wade Davis signed just at the right time that we were able to talk about him, and the producers were rejoicing. It was like manna from heaven, an actual free agent contract that we could talk about. So that took care of the A block, and then we had to vamp from there out.
I think that's why I got invited in part. It turned out there was a few bits of news to talk about, including, unfortunately, Kevin Towers passing, which basically the news broke of that morning as I was driving in. But I think one reason that they wanted a guy who was history oriented was that, you know, my stuff is so far past its sell-by date, it's current again. So if there was no A block, they could have just been like, do you want to talk about Goose Goslin's nose for 10 minutes? Like, we could do that. He had a large nose, didn't he? You know, so fortunately, we didn't have to do that. But it's been strange. And I want to talk about more about that in practical terms. But first, I do want to thank you for coming, because listeners will note that this is your third appearance on the show. And the first was planned. As we discussed at that time, I held it off till a properly ceremonious moment when the show had been established and I could formally thank you and welcome you again for encouraging me. And then the other two times were not planned. They were because somebody at that time had a conflict or bailed. And so people want to peek behind the curtain that if Ben reappears, because I try to, you do so much of this. Yeah. And I know as your friend that what you contend with in terms of deadlines in your daily life. So I really only like to break glass in case of an emergency. And so I am very grateful.
Yes, so people can speculate about who the original guest was whenever I come on the podcast. I must have been pinch hitting for someone. But yeah, it's always a pleasure to fill in when I can. And like you, I work from home and we're often up at odd hours emailing each other about the Beatles at 4 a.m. or something. So our schedules kind of align sometimes, although occasionally one of us will briefly be on a regular person schedule and the other will still be inverted. And then we probably never even overlap. But for a lot of the days, we seem to be aligned.
There are whole weeks that I don't sleep for 2-3 days at a time when we're probably overlapping way too much, and I'm actually not very useful. But since you brought up this wonderful game of guessing who Ben is replacing, I thought I would just ask you the questions that I prepared for the fellow who's not here. So number one, you became a nationally recognized expert, air quotes, on pitching mechanics, despite no experience or formal training. Your latest book, though, is about rectal health. How did that change of careers come about? And what do ball players need to know to take care of their rectum?
Oh, I don't think I'm prepared to speak on this subject. I'm sorry to leave you in the lurch.
More seriously, this may seem frivolous. This is not about the slow winter or the brewing labor troubles that are coming up. And again, we'll talk about that. But one thing that we were talking about during one of those nights when we were overlapping recently, this stuck in my mind. I don't know if it stuck in yours. And I don't want to spoil what you were working on, because I believe you just hinted to me that had not been published yet. You sent me half a sentence about Mike Trout. And I completed the sentence by saying that Mike Trout has been passing as a man all these years, that in fact, he is actually female. And I'm not asserting that on a factual basis, but as a hypothetical, it's not impossible. And if you go to Wikipedia, there is a long, long, long list of people, women who have cross-dressed as men and enlisted in wars. And it seems to me like it would be hard to pass in a clubhouse where people are showering and stuff, but it'd be hard to pass in an army too. And so my question is, do you think this has ever happened?
Well, you're the baseball historian here. You would probably have a better sense than I. I mean, it probably would have been easier to get away with in an earlier era of baseball history, I would think, when maybe scouting and background checks were not quite so rigorous. Guys would just show up off the train, right? You'd send them a ticket and they'd show up from the middle of nowhere and they'd be in the lineup the next day. So in that sense, it probably would have been easier, I think, at that time than today, when you have a database on every guy going back to the time they were 12. So I would think it would be difficult to have happened now, but I could certainly see a case where in an earlier time that sort of thing would have been very feasible.
There's a very famous story of a jazz musician named Billy Tipton, who was a woman passing as a man for something like 70 years and had a wife. I don't think she was formally a wife, but in all practical purposes, a wife, had 3 adopted children, and nobody cottoned to the fact that this was someone who was biologically female until she died and they were trying to revive her. I should say him, just out of respect, because that is the way that Billy Tipton chose to live his life. But nobody figured this out, not the person that he was living with, not the 3 children, until after the fact. And if you look at if you look at pictures of Billy Tipton, you could say, well, you know, if you know, then it seems kind of obvious. But if you don't know, I guess it wouldn't be. So yeah, you're right. I'm the historian, but I would be doing this terrible thing of kind of going through old baseball cards and going, well, maybe him. And I don't think that's right.
So. Yeah. Mike Trout's probably not the first player I would pick if I were to perform that exercise. But you never know.
What if it was Gene Garber? Like that beard, that really big beard, that was like a way of masking literally a beard, as they call it, to deflect suspicion. Yes.
That'd be one way to do it. And there are many suspicious beards in baseball today, so could be.
I do think it would be wonderful though, and I don't just mean the passing, but the fantasy of a female ball player, I think, is the next great frontier to be crossed. And I always wonder why baseball is so resistant to it, because that woman would be hailed as the new Jackie Robinson, not the same thing, not exactly the same parallel to the struggle of African Americans for equality in this country. And then again, women have had a similarly long struggle for equality in this country. So I think it would have a different symbolic value, but still very strong symbolic value nonetheless.
Well, I watched Pitched and I liked Pitch, and I was sorry it was canceled. And obviously, if something like that were to happen in real life, it would be the biggest story in sports, the biggest story in the country. It would be wonderful. There are many reasons, of course, why that hasn't happened. And I don't know if we could say that it's really right on the horizon. Obviously, there have been a lot of women who have played in independent leagues and college ball and many very talented, but I don't think we've really come close to it yet.
I mean, we need the talent intake for that, and it doesn't exist. It can't just be one woman. I mean, that's what the Negro Leagues functioned as, even in terms of Jackie Robinson. That was the sorting mechanism by which Branch Rickey knew to identify him. That and his play at UCLA and everything. You need this huge population of women that have been playing the game since they were kids, and then you can sort through them. You know, when Kevin Goldstein was on a couple of weeks ago, he had a number, and I have to go back and check what the number was, but he said that one of the hardest parts of his job, or just being in a front office, was cut down day in the low minors. And he said that they had the numbers on it, and that the vast, vast majority of those guys do not get re-signed, whether they're American prospects or college kids, high school kids, or from the Dominican. They are, the moment they get cut from A ball or short season, whatever, they are officially done with baseball.
Yeah, I had sort of the same experience back in 2015 when Sam Miller and I were running the Sonoma Stompers and writing a book about it. And of course, the Sonoma Stompers have featured women players in the last couple seasons. But we had that same kind of thing where there was a league-wide tryout and, you know, lots of sad faces at the end of it, because those guys, I mean, at that level, especially if you get cut from the Pacific Association, there's nowhere to go, really. So that was sad. We felt bad about it, and I think it probably affected the way we ran the team in the regular season, because we would get attached to guys and we'd be around them and we wouldn't want to have that conversation where you sit someone down and tell them their dream is dead, which is essentially what you're doing at that level of baseball.
I say that when I get up pretty much every morning, actually, to go write about whatever. It sometimes is true and sometimes is not. I don't want to put myself in that same boat though. And that's one thing is curious. You were the spreadsheet guy in the book. You were the guy, I'm not trying to shortchange Sam, but the way it read, and maybe this was just because these were your chapters, you were the one who had assembled this universe of players that, and this was a purposeful part of the experience. This is not, or the experiment, this is not how a real team would do it, but a major league team. I mean, there's nothing unreal about the Sonoma Stompers, but you had this list of people that you had not seen, had certainly not personally scouted, but had just taken from, these were undrafted guys who had interesting looking stats. And you were calling people, you were calling their moms, you were calling all around which, as somebody who's shy and who hesitates to call to order a pizza, this is like, I cannot believe that you did this. Cause for me, that would have been the end of I would have had to return the advance. I'm that reclusive, but you did this. And so did the fact that you had to cajole some of these guys to leave whatever else they were doing, having given up on the dream, to come out to Sonoma for not a whole lot of money and then release them? Did you feel extra pain for like, God, I'm sorry I put you to this inconvenience. You got a trip to wine country at least. I realize that doesn't make up for it. I mean, did that make you feel even more personally responsible?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I think there was only maybe one player that Sam and I signed from the spreadsheet who ended up just not working out. And so that was pretty painful. Yeah, I mean, it was a bruise to our egos too, because we had signed him, but also we just felt bad about it. And I mean, it wasn't so hard to call them because you're offering a kid a chance to play professional baseball, which is, you know, it's like Publishers Clearinghouse or something called, you know, so it's, you get to be the bearer of good news. So in that sense, that wasn't unpleasant. It was kind of embarrassing. I mean, I know you know the feeling, having been an editor at sites that have employed unpaid people or pushed you to employ unpaid people. It's, you know, it's like, hey, would you like to write for this site? That's good news. But then would you like to do it for free? That's not so good. And you feel kind of dirty even proposing it. So I had the same feeling when I was saying to players that, you know, you can play pro ball, but it's for this team you've never heard of on the other side of the country, and you may or may not get scouted or seen or signed by anyone, and, you know, you are going to make this much, yes, that much, yes, I really said that much, and, you know, we may or may not be able to cover your transportation costs. I mean, you know, so you feel a bit embarrassed about it, but there were a lot of players who wanted to do it, and it did help a little bit that it was Sonoma, and you could say, well, it's a nice place to spend a summer at the very least.
But then it's been on fire for a year, so I'm not sure how you would handle that now. And I don't mean to joke about that, because it's a tragic thing, and people have lost their houses. And I, at different times, I've asked you and Sam, is everybody okay? Now you would have to say, come to literal hell.
Yes, and it would be a harder sell at this point. That's for sure.
I'm sure that, and we've already talked about it a little bit in this show, you're tired of talking about this strange, paralyzed offseason that baseball has had. But there's one aspect of it I feel like has gone under-remarked. And maybe this is, again, my, you know, Goose Goslin perspective, or that the business has changed so much and that my sense of this is dated. But ticket sales are still a big part of a team's income. I know that people like to feel that television is all and everything, and certainly they do make a great deal of money depending on the team from television. I mean, they all make some great deal of money. It may be relative between, say, the Reds and the Yankees. But this used to be, and by this I mean November, December, January, the time of year that you did stuff that wouldn't necessarily ensure that you would win a pennant the next year. It might not even ensure that you would go 500, but it would encourage people to buy season tickets. It would encourage people to look at the schedule and want to buy seats for games, because, again, you might not win, but you had signed this guy and you had picked up this player who is going to be fun to watch. And so this was your way of drumming up business and making money for the season. And that free agent player or that player that you traded for was an investment. And the number that I keep coming back to, and this number is like stuck in my brain like an ice pick, there's an image for you, is that the Cincinnati Reds starting rotation last year had the highest ERA in the National League. It's a very easy number to remember, 5.55. And they have done nothing about that. Mm-hmm. The Orioles had the highest ERA in the American League. And yeah, it's not as easy a number to remember, but they have literally, I think, not made a move this offseason. Or if they have, it's some very fringy 26th guy kind of move. So never mind what is happening with the overall economics of the game or some of these players. Why are they just forgoing this opportunity to get people psyched to go to the ballpark?
Yeah, RJ Anderson did an article on this almost a month ago at CBS Sports, where he talked to marketing and ticketing people with teams and said, how are you doing your jobs, essentially, when you have no way to sell your product, you know, based on off-season excitement? And they all just seem to say, oh, it's, you know, all systems go and we're just selling the concept of the team. But that can be a pretty tough sell in some cases. So I think you're right. I mean, maybe you could say that there just weren't that many players on this winter's market who would really get fans psyched to buy season tickets or any tickets, which is possibly part of the problem here. You know, it's not next year when we'll be talking about Kershaw and Harper and Machado. It's, you know, I don't know whether anyone gets that excited about JD Martinez and says, all right, we have to take the family to the park because JD Martinez is going to be DHing today. So I don't know that that caliber of player really was involved, but of course, you know, winning usually sells tickets and brings people to the ballpark. And there certainly are a lot of teams that are not pulling out all the stops to do that right now.
Well, I mean, don't you think, again, this is kind of an unlikely scenario, but I'll just throw it out there. To continue with the Reds and that ERA as an example, don't you think that if you were sitting outside Cincinnati and thinking about going to a ballgame, you might say, well, it's Yu Darvish today and not Brandon Finnegan. Maybe we should go check it out. He can be fun.
Yeah, there must be someone who thinks that. I think based on what I've read and the research I've seen, and I can't remember really any specific studies, but my impression is that people have generally found that unless you're talking about a real superstar, you can't really price in some kind of marquee value or ticket bonus. You know, I mean, you'll often hear that so-and-so will put butts in the seats, but I think it probably only applies to a more elite class of player than maybe was available this winter. I mean, sure, I guess if you're deciding between Yu Darvish starts and Anthony DeSclafani starts or something, I'm sure that's an incentive to go to the park on the Yu Darvish day. But even then, I mean, I don't know. I did an article once, I think, at Grantland's looking at starting pitchers who were real draws, like, you know, the real sensations, Fernando Valenzuela, guys like that, where you could look at the team's attendance on days when they were not starting versus the team's attendance on days when they were starting. And, you know, you can imagine that Shohei Ohtani might have that sort of effect this season. But I'm not sure that you really get that. Maybe you get it with Jake Arrieta, but I mean, it just seems like there's an argument for a bad team that knows it's not going to win right now to sign one of these guys just so that they'll be more watchable, so that they'll get to some minimum level of competence. But usually I think the team that is kind of on the cusp of winning or can expect to win has greater incentive to sign that guy. And so they would end up paying a premium for him. But as it is, no one's paying a premium for anyone.
That's a fair point. And if I remember your piece and similar ones that have been done over the years, you can see that effect with maybe Nolan Ryan or Roger Clemens. Fernando was maybe another one. But other than that, it's a very small or not detectable number, right?
Yeah.
You're right that every one of these players who remains, there is an argument not to sign them. And I do think in that sense that we maybe don't have collusion. We have a perfect storm of broken toys, or misfit toys. I mean, they're not necessarily broken. They're just limited. And one is that I keep coming back to is Moustakas, who, yes, he's a power hitting third baseman, but he's a power hitting third baseman with a relatively low on base percentage and a high platoon factor, and doesn't necessarily play the kind of defense where you'd say, like, okay, well, he's not going to hit left-handers, but he's so great with the glove that we should list him anyway. One guy, I just parenthetically, one guy that I always think about that way is Greg Nettles, who was that good with the glove, but really throughout his career should have been, if you want to be really literal about his hitting abilities, a platoon player. He was terrible against left-handed pitching. However, he was also like a plus 30 or plus 40 in some years on defense. So you say, you know what? You know, we'll get it back. But Moustakas isn't that guy. And so you can make that same argument for everybody. Yeah. And you get this constipation thing. Mm-hmm. But one, to get back to rectal health, but one guy I kind of you're going to mock this, and it might be fair to mock this. I feel like the canary in the coal mine, if there's collusion, is Jared Dyson. Mm. Because Yes, he's 33. Yes, he's basically never hit a home run in his life. Okay, 12, but that's, you know, only 12 more than I've hit. He, by Baseball Reference, B-War, because of his speed and defense as a platoon center field guy for the Mariners, was worth 2.6 wins last year. And that's pretty much what he does every year, even though his career averages are 258, 325, 352. Mm-hmm. He runs around, he catches the ball, he plays 100 games. And it seems to me, unless I overestimate the avarice of Jared Dyson's agents at CSE, that Jared Dyson would be the kind of player that a team that is on the cusp of the playoffs or is a team, I'm not saying the Yankees should do it, but a team like the Yankees who just might need a fourth outfielder or a fifth outfielder and is, you know, could give somebody 300 at bats, he would be the guy to sign. So in a world where everything is equal and it's just that they're all Moustakas flawed free agents, Jared Dyson already gets signed for some reasonable amount of money.
Yeah, and there have been teams that have expressed interest or at least have been rumored to. And, you know, he's been linked to the Giants who have a need for him, and the Mariners had a need for him. He was with them last year. They decided to trade for a second baseman, D. Gordon, and move him to Dyson's position, which is a roundabout way of filling that hole. So, or you could even look at Todd Frazier. I mean, I joked about him earlier, but for him to sign, what, a two-year, $17 million deal, I mean, based on the kind of accounting that we've done every winter for the last several years, where you say a win is worth X million dollars of, you know, free agent spending, well, I mean, do that accounting for him, and a one-year $17 million deal wouldn't have been that far out of line. He's been not a great player, but an above-average player, really, for each of the last several years, you know, a 2-3-4 win guy. And so based on how we thought the market worked, someone like him would have gotten more money than he ended up getting. So I don't know. I mean, you do hear from some guys, like if you read a report that says, well, Eric Hosmer has multiple 7-year offers and he's holding out for a 9-year offer, you think, well, maybe the fault there lies with Eric Hosmer or with Scott Boras for thinking that there's a 9-year offer out there for a player like him. But when there is this much of a backlog, I mean, it can't be all people who are holding out for unreasonable deals. It has to be an absence of offers in some cases, at least.
Do you think teams, the contending teams in particular, are sitting there saying, well, we don't want to clog up our roster with guys who expect to play because in July we're going to get to trade for Bryce Harper?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't expect that to happen, but certainly some teams are probably looking ahead toward next winter and thinking about that. And there's so many theories and explanations for what is happening this winter, and we've been hearing them going back to November, and they've changed. I mean, at the beginning of the offseason, a lot of people thought that maybe it was just everyone waiting to see where Ohtani would go and where Stanton would go, and that seems like an awfully long time ago. And there are many other theories now, and of course, there's the competitive balance tax and teams trying to get under the threshold in some cases, and you can question why they're even trying so hard to get under it, given how much cash they all seem to have on hand these days and the skyrocketing values of franchises. So it's really hard to figure how it all just kind of came to a head now. I mean, it was just over a year ago that the current CBA was negotiated, and it seemed to just sort of fly through. And now, of course, you have labor unrest and people sparring in the press in a way that they really haven't since the strike era. So it's hard to see how this all happened so fast. I mean, I think that there were trends you could look at and say that things are pointing this way. And it's not surprising that teams have gotten more disciplined in the free agent market, just because we've all been pointing out for years and years and years that these long-term deals for free agents tend not to favor the team. So I guess they finally read the blog posts all at once or something. It's hard to understand how they all came to the same conclusion now. But I mean, there is really no team that is an outlier in the way that it evaluates players anymore. Even just a couple of years ago, we could point to a team like the Diamondbacks and Dave Stewart or the Twins and Terry Ryan and sort of these old school guys who maybe weren't quite in lockstep with the rest of the league that had embraced data. And now there just isn't really any team like that. There was always someone. Like, there was a Dayton Moore. I mean, Dayton Moore's still around, but he seems to have evolved somewhat. There was always some holdout, some sort of, you know, anti-stats person. And now there just isn't anymore. So maybe that's the answer.
I own a secondhand furniture store, and I think my prices are fair. 'Cause this real cheap guy I know came in one day, saw this chair he wanted to buy, but he wouldn't. Claimed the price was too high. So I looked him straight in his eye, and this was my reply. If I can't sell it, I'm gonna sit down on it. I ain't gonna give it away. Now, darling, if you want it, you're gonna have to buy it. And I mean just what I say. Now, how'd you like to find this waiting at home for you every night? Only been used once or twice, but it's still nice and tight. Oh! So if I can't sell it, I'm gonna keep sitting on it. I ain't about to give it away.
Steve here, interrupting the great Ruth Brown with the 1930s novelty number, If I Can't Sell It, I'll Keep Sitting on It, to tell you that we're about to take a break for a word from our sponsor, or just the winds of Nirvana, not Nirvana the band, the other Nirvana, and we'll be right back with more me and Ben Lindbergh. And really, you're just here for the Ben Lindbergh, right? Right after that.
Because it's made for comfort. Built for wear and tear. Where else would you find such a easy chair?
We both know people in analytics departments of various ball clubs, and it is tempting to call them and say, are you getting more FaceTime with the GM than you used to? Have you dissuaded every and all move based on the fact that the player in question is 32 and just, you know, the marginal value is just not that great over whoever's at AAA? It really does seem that way.
Yeah. I mean, it's got to be partially just the strange sort of hierarchy of baseball right now. And I don't know whether it's really worth hand wringing or not. It may just be one of those cyclical things, but certainly we do seem to be in a state where the good teams are really good and a lot of teams are not. And I think Pecota projects all of last year's playoff teams to be playoff teams again. And it was almost like, you know, the day the World Series ended, you could almost just say, you know, with the exception of maybe the wild card teams, you could really just forecast every playoff team to be a playoff team in 2018 if they didn't do anything. I mean, it wasn't like, you know, the Astros ended up trading for Gerrit Cole, but they could have said, okay, we're done the day of the parade, and they probably would have won the AL West this year. So there are a lot of teams like that maybe just don't have the incentive. Like, you know, the Dodgers could use Yu Darvish, and he seems to want to go back. But right now their Pecota projection says they're 10 games better than any other team in the National League. So do they need to go over that tax if they think there's some benefit to staying under it and being able to re-sign Kershaw next year? Or do they just say, well, we're going to get there, and, you know, look, we traded for Darvish last year and we didn't win a World Series. It only guarantees you so much. So I think maybe there are just more teams like that right now than there usually are. And so a little less incentive for some of them to make that move. But then there are teams kind of in the middle ground, like the Angels, like the Brewers, that seem to have taken advantage of that idleness on the part of some of the powerhouses. So maybe there is kind of an opportunity there.
Speaking of the Brewers, do you feel like it was Bud Selig back when he was driving the labor conflict towards the competitive balance tax and or competitive balance payments, excuse me, so that teams were going to make a certain amount of money regardless of what they did, that took out some of the incentive for some of these clubs to try to muscle up and challenge the Yankees, Astros, Dodgers, and so forth?
Yeah, that might be what's happening now. I think, you know, whether you like or dislike Selig, I think that the measures he put in place helped in some way for a while there, at least. I think if you compare, you know, the last 20 years to the 90s, the Yankees dynasty, that era when everyone was so worried about competitive balance, I think there has been a lot more parity in the years since. So I think if that was his goal, and maybe that was partly his goal and partly was just suppressing salaries, and, you know, maybe that's working now too. But I think, I mean, baseball's competitive balance is still really strong compared to the other major sports. And I'm not sure whether we're just kind of in a phase now where it seems like, I don't know. I mean, there's nothing to talk about all winter, right? So we're all wondering if baseball is doomed in some way. And we always occupy ourselves by talking about something, whether it's the pace of play or, you know, strikeout rates or something, some threat to the game. And that's fine. I think it's fine to be vigilant and to monitor those things. And I think Major League Baseball should be monitoring those things. But you know from studying baseball history that people are always wringing their hands about something that is going to destroy baseball. And up until this point, it hasn't. And baseball is always changing. And, you know, certainly earlier eras of baseball, you always had bad teams and you often had teams that were just barely financially viable, which now, you know, with the exception of maybe the Marlins, isn't really the case. I mean, there were teams that were also ran for decades at a time and never contended and could barely make payroll or had to trade guys for cash essentially just to make payroll. So in that sense, I think we're probably better off than we were in a lot of earlier eras in baseball. But, you know, there's only so much to talk about and write about over the winter, and there's no new action. So I think we all sort of speculate and worry about where things are headed.
It's kind of fascinating that there were those interventions then. In modern times, we've really only had one, and it was about a big market team. It was when the McCourts owned the Dodgers and had driven them into the ground. But I never get – there are a couple of things I never get bored of thinking about. And one of the teams that you just mentioned is the Phillies, who went to the World Series in 1915. And then starting not long after that, straight through to about 1948 or 1949, climaxing in a World Series appearance in 1950, lost 90 to 100 games or more every single year.
Right.
And – you know, fired the grounds crew and bought sheep and, know, like, and whoever they got that was good, they traded them.
Yeah, and there were, you know, de facto farm teams for other teams, which is not really something that we have today so much. So, you know, I don't know. I think the game is financially a lot better off in most respects. And I guess that's part of the problem now is that the game is doing so well financially and the players feel like they're not reaping the rewards of that.
So we're going to have a homeless camp, apparently managed by Bo Porter in spring training. And I wonder what any of those guys really has to prove other than getting hurt. You know, the first guy who tears an Achilles tendon while playing in a, you know, warming up in a homeless camp game, he's sort of been doubly cursed. Mm-hmm. But I do wonder if, and I was just reading that some of the signed players are going to go there before the reporting date in a show of solidarity and work out with the guys. And I'm wondering if there's a scenario in which JT Realmuto goes there and then refuses to leave once the regular camps open.
Yeah, it's funny that this is happening. I did a little retrospective about the 1995 Homestead Camp just a couple of weeks ago at the Ringer when this first started to surface. I didn't think it would necessarily even happen, but I didn't remember the details. I know you've mentioned the Homestead Camp a couple times on the podcast in passing, but I was, you know, not really old enough to be a very plugged in baseball fan at that point. So I had no personal recollection of this. And so it was sort of fascinating for me to dive into what to this point, I think has been a unique occurrence in baseball history. And evidently it's about to be no longer a unique occurrence. But I went and talked to people who were at the camp. I talked to Jackie Moore, who was the manager then, the Bo Porter of his day. And I talked to, gosh, who else? Lloyd McClendon and Jay Howell and Tim Belcher, a bunch of players who were there. And, you know, they were all saying, this is unique. It's one of the strangest things I ever had to do in my career. And let's hope it never happens again. And it appears that it is happening again. So I guess that was well timed. But, you know, it was a singular event that it's sort of scary that this is happening again, because, of course, that happened in the aftermath of the strike. And no one wants to see anything happen like was happening back during the strike, because we all want baseball to continue. So it is a little worrisome. But, you know, it was fun to go back and talk to those guys, because it was almost like movie material or something. They, you know, this team of misfits and no one wanted them, and there was the strike, and they all kind of bonded together over this and became friends and almost talked about it in a warm way, you know, remembering it decades later. But at the time, for some of them, it was not really a pleasant experience. And I think when they all showed up at that camp, they expected to get jobs, and most of them did, but some of them didn't. And they were just left waiting there at the end, like, you know, the player who doesn't get picked in gym class. And they saw all their teammates sign deals with major league teams, minor league teams, and they just went home and retired. So, you know, that could be the case again for some players this year. And it's sad, obviously.
That was me, the guy who didn't get picked in gym class. So you're bringing up some bad. Remember, we used to have these forced units like tennis. And even before I lost half my sight, I just didn't have the eye-hand coordination to play tennis at all. And so we had to play doubles. And in fact, Rick Mooring, who co-wrote the theme song for the show, as I say every week, is an aces tennis player. And so I would partner with him, and just every gym class, I would go on the court, and the guys on the other side of the net would hit the ball, and I would say, yours, yours, yours. And they'd say, no, you have to alternate hits. And I'd say, shut up, yours, yours. And that was how I handled it. So I do empathize with the Homestead guys.
Seems like it would have been easy to exploit that for the other team once they figured out that there was one guy who did not want to hit the ball back.
Well, you have to understand that Rick, in addition to being an ace composer and a physicist, has just incredible range. He was
and speed.
Kind of the odd.
Three and a half miler, as I heard on last week's episode.
Exactly. He was like the Ozzie Smith and Ricky Henderson of New Jersey high school students. And so he could do it. He could cover an entire tennis court against two people, and he still talks to me. So he was maybe enabling me. I don't know. But again, as I said with the 32nd mile last week, it was good for his ego, I think. So in that sense, I feel good about being that guy. I was like the teen movie sidekick, you know. I was to his main character in The Breakfast Club or something.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is not an experience that many major leaguers have had. These are the guys who were the first player picked for every team in their life. So to be at this point in the market and not have anyone calling or not have any satisfactory offers, that's got to be a blow to your ego as an athlete. And athletes, I think, often have inflated senses of their own excellence, which is, you know, probably a good evolutionary trait for an athlete to have, and probably gives them the confidence to succeed under enormous pressure and skepticism from others and scrutiny. So this has got to be something that these guys are not at all used to.
I do also want to mention about Jackie Moore that since you brought him up, and how often does Jackie Moore get mentioned these days? Jackie Moore was briefly the manager of the Oakland A's in the 1980s. And again, this goes back to high school for me, but I encourage everyone to Google his Topps cards, because I don't know why this would happen, but I had a good friend, also a musician who I haven't roped into this particular enterprise yet, and an aces writer. But from time to time, he would just kind of walk up to me and say, "Smiling Jackie Moore." And if you look at his Topps cards, You'll know why, because on every one of his Oakland A's manager cards, he is really happy to be there.
He was happy to talk to me on the phone. So he is still smiling, I guess. And he was happy to be the manager of that team, I think. He was a free agent himself. I mean, he was in baseball. He's mostly retired now, but he was in baseball for 57 years, he was telling me, and he was a player. He very briefly made the majors in 1 year and then went on to be a coach and a manager at many levels in many organizations for years and years. And he just happened to be available that spring. And he was very flattered. I don't know whether Bo Porter is as flattered as Jackie Moore was to be asked to manage this team, but he took it as a compliment that the Players Association thought that he was popular and respected enough to be the manager who could kind of corral all these unemployed veterans. And they told me that he was the perfect manager for that team because he was not like a hard ass guy who, you know, there was no reason to be in that camp because they weren't trying to pull together a team that would win in the regular season or anything. So he was kind of an easygoing guy, players manager, and everyone was a veteran and could go about their business. So spring training sort of ran itself in that case.
And you think about it, it's a challenging job because A, the players don't really want to be there. Mm-hmm. And two, what if at this camp you not only have Hosmer, but you have Logan Morrison and Lucas Duda and, I don't know, another five for first baseman, and they can't all get reps all the time.
Yeah.
So, you know, somebody is going to have to sit and be and stew at some of the so there are egos to manage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds like the Scott Boras guys won't be there, so maybe that helps a little bit. But he was telling me about how, you know, he never knew what team was going to show up from day to day. So he would go home and he'd hear on the news that his second baseman just signed with somewhere, so he would be gone the next day, or he wouldn't even hear on the news and he'd just show up the next morning and he'd walk around with a roster and check off the names of the guys who were still there and X out the guys who just didn't show up that day. So it was not
Bueller.
It was just not a typical spring training in that respect. And he was saying, you know, it's like the opposite where he would just be, there were scouts there that were sent by the teams to see these guys. And, you know, usually the scouts would not be like fraternizing with the players and the manager. But in this case, he was trying to be an advocate for these guys. So he would tell the scouts whatever they wanted. He invited them down onto the field during batting practice and they couldn't believe it. But it was, I mean, the whole camp was just an exhibition, an audition for these guys. So there was no reason not to. And the situation has changed, obviously, quite a bit in the 23 years since then, in that I don't know that players even need spring training now to the extent that they used to. We always talk about how it's probably longer than it has to be. And now that players are just in shape year round and they all have personal trainers and instructors who are helping them get ready for the season, they may not need it as much. And, you know, if they want to get seen by a team, they can just tweet a video of themselves taking batting practice or something. They don't necessarily need to be in a camp like this. So there's probably a little less incentive. And I think that's probably part of why the Boras guys aren't planning to be there. He has a whole, you know, complex and a whole staff devoted to optimizing guys' performance. So they don't necessarily need to go to spring training. They have other ways to get up to speed.
Well, the really famous example of quote spring training being too long goes back to, again, a related situation even a little earlier than the Homestead camp, but in the mid 80s, Tim Raines, as part of collusion, fell into this weird rule where you can't re-sign with your team until May 1st if you haven't signed by a certain date. It's been so long since we've dealt with this particular one that I've forgotten some of the details, but he went cold from, I guess not his couch. I assume he was, you know, doing something, but right back to the Montreal Expos. And for the first 55, 60 games of that season, he hit about 380.
Yeah. The very first game, right? Dramatic comeback, home runs. So, Tim Raines is maybe not the typical player, but, you know, and maybe if you're a pitcher, it's probably more important to kind of get up to speed and get that conditioning and get your arm ready, because that can be such a dangerous time of the year. I once did an article on how March and early April is like the Tommy John hotspot, because partially probably because there are some guys who've been just nursing injuries all winter and hoped that whatever it was would just go away by the time they got back to camp. And so no one knew about it, and it's not really a new injury. But I think there are a lot of guys who just have a greater than normal amount of injuries in that month, just because they are going from less activity to more activity, and they're trying to get into game shape and get their arms ready. And, you know, maybe some teams push them too hard. Maybe some teams don't push them hard enough. So it can be a very risky time for players. And I wonder whether maybe by avoiding that, you just bypass some of the injury risk, or whether you just increase it when you actually do get in back into a game.
Well, I think there's a happy medium. I mean, for anybody, whether you're a ball player or a normal human, we wouldn't advise going right from Netflix and chill into some kind of heavy exercise. That's a good way to die. I mean, that's why every winter so many people croak shoveling snow out of their driveways or whatever, because they've you know, not used to that kind of physical exertion. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's kind of an extreme version of the same, but I think you're absolutely right. And for people who don't recall the game that you were referencing, after Tim Raines was by baseball law excluded from the beginning of the 1987 season on May 2nd, 1987 at Shea Stadium against the Mets, he made his season debut. The game was an 11-7 Expos win, but it went to the 10th. The Expos at that point were trailing 7-6, and Raines, as part of that dramatic comeback, again, not having done anything as far as we know baseball wise for quite the while, went 4-for-5 in that game with 4 RBIs, a walk, 3 runs scored. He hit a triple and a home run, including a grand slam off of Jesse Orosco in the 10th to propel the Expos to that comeback. Oh, and also he stole a base off of David Cone and Gary Carter. So
that's a Hall of Famer.
He was an incredible player, and it's a separate discussion as to why that took so long. Spring training is way too long, and it's a shame that for some players it's going to get longer instead of shorter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, I wonder whether some of the rhetoric we're hearing now will die down once the season starts, once these guys sign, which they have to one day at some point, one would think. And you know, if not, we're in for an awful lot of warring through the press, because we don't have a CBA negotiation coming up for years. I mean, the CBA doesn't expire till 2021. The players are probably wishing that they could have the last one back, but at this point, it's going to be a while until they really get a chance to change it. So I don't know whether next winter there will be enough money spent on those high profile free agents that maybe some of this will subside for a while. I mean, I think they're probably are real structural issues that have to be addressed and that the players will try to address, but it's going to be a while before they can really effectively do that. And I don't know whether both sides can maintain the level of animosity that they seem to have for each other right now. Although I guess they did that throughout the 80s and 90s pretty comfortably.
Oh my God. I mean, from Marvin Miller on. Yeah. So for much longer than that. Well, let's not go there, but let's conclude on this note. This is something that I sort of asked rhetorically on Twitter earlier today, and I was wondering what you thought about it. But since we are talking about Pakota coming out and Zips coming out and various other projections and things for the coming season, how valid can those things be right now if some important players are still unsigned? I mean, there's always some element of that. And, you know, someone who worked on the BP annual with me, you know that there's a lot of guesswork that goes into trying to look at what teams are doing when you're doing it from the vantage point of the offseason, because things always do change. Someone can break a leg, someone can get traded. But now we have over 100 guys, some of whom, as flawed as we were just saying, and Arrieta or Moustakas might be, are still really important frontline players who could at the very least, are if they don't alter a team's destiny, are going to displace other players who will then lose playing time, and therefore our projections are just wrong.
Yeah, I mean, we should probably never underestimate the imprecision of the projections as it is. They're always just sort of rough guides to how we think the season will go, and they're the best guess, and they're better than I could do picking teams and players, I'm sure, but you know, there are always teams that defy them. The average error of a team is something like 7 wins or something. So it's not as if they're ever just, you know, laser targeted perfectly. But you're right. In theory, at least, there should be bigger error bars around the projections now than there usually are at this time of year. And there aren't that many players who would swing a projection probably more than 2 or 3 wins in any one direction. So unless there's one team that just decides to swoop in and gobble up all the remaining free agents, I wouldn't expect it to dramatically change the standings. I think, you know, something like when the Brewers get Kane and Yelich on one day, or when the Angels get Ohtani and then make a bunch of subsequent moves, that kind of thing really can move the needle. But if we're just talking about, you know, the Red Sox adding JD Martinez or something like that, I don't know if that really changes the ordinal rankings that you would expect in a division. But I mean, there are definitely some teams that you look at and say, well, here's this obvious glaring hole and here's this obvious glaring way to plug that hole, and for some reason you haven't done it yet. So at least it's, you know, usually February and March are pretty slow months for baseball. So, you know, spring training starts and we all get excited and we see guys stretching and that's fun for a day or two, but then we remember that nothing really happens at that point for another several weeks. So at least there's potentially more intrigue here on that front than there usually is.
That's true. It these months may be less anticlimactic because we'll be able to talk about some of these guys shaking out. It's just, again, and this is not a new thought, we don't know what is going to unplug the dam. We don't know what is going to lead to the stampede that will finally let that happen. And then suddenly we have to reevaluate everything that, or at least some aspects of what we've thought about these teams to this point.
Yeah, it seems like it's sort of a game of chicken at this point. There must be offers out there that just haven't been deemed satisfactory. And I guess it comes down to who blinked first. And I mean, probably there's more pressure on the players to blink than the teams, because I just don't know that there are that many difference makers out there right now. So, you know, if you're a team, you can wait if you've decided that there's some number that for whatever reason you're unwilling to budge from. You can wait, but if you're that player, I mean, that's tough, because you only have so long in the career of a professional athlete, and to watch the calendar days just flip by, and, you know, that would be agonizing, I'm sure.
I hate to close on a down note, but I mean, to go back to that same period of collusion that Tim Raines was a part of, I remember, and you will be too young to recall this, or possibly too not born to recall this. I lost track of the exact date, but one of those winters, Jack Morris was a free agent. And I realized that Jack Morris is no longer regarded the same way that he was then, and properly, because, you know, some people with the Hall of Fame just decided we had to have Jack Morris in the Hall of Fame no matter what. Damn it, we were going to get him. Believe it or not, at that time, people who played Strat understood that Jack Morris was overrated just because they could see the sheer number of hits on the card. But everybody else thought, because of the one-loss records, that he was just this great, great pitcher. And I don't want to take away from the fact he certainly wasn't a bad pitcher, but he was a free agent. And so the talk going into the hot stove that season or that winter was, where is Jack Morris going to go? Who's going to sign Jack Morris? You know, the Yankees might sign Jack Morris because their entire starting rotation is 42, and they could use a staff leader guy like Jack Morris. Or maybe he'll go to the Dodgers. They're great with pitchers. Oral Hershiser and Jack Morris together at last, the Titanic team up that you demanded. And then it was, wait, no one wants Jack Morris? Nobody? Yeah. He just, okay, he's going to go back. Like, and so it was all anticlimactic. And obviously, you know, labor struggles are terrible and not what we want to be talking about. And that was a drag. And this whole winter just feels wrong. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I don't, I mean, maybe certainly from a writer, there's an appeal in having some big drama, some existential crisis. Not that anyone wants anyone to be out of work or for the sport to be in jeopardy, but you know, there have been so many think pieces written this winter about why this is happening and what could be done to correct it. And it gives you something to discuss, at least. And you're right, when this eventually gets resolved, it may just sort of be with a thud. And, you know, players will show up and that'll be that. And we hope that this won't be a continuing story for the next few seasons, but it very well may be. But, you know, I mean, I think you've written in the past maybe about how, I mean, individual moves we probably make more of than we should in many cases, especially with trade deadline moves, for instance. You know, they seem earth-shattering when they happen and seem paradigm-altering, but so rarely do you look back. And I know that you did this for the BP Pennant Race book, right? But, yep. You know, it's rare that one move really makes the difference and puts the team over the edge. And the guy that you traded for happens to get the game winning hit in game 7 of the World Series. It just doesn't happen all that often. And I think the same is true with free agents, especially when you're talking about 2 to 4 win type free agents, like the guys who are lingering forever on this market. It's just, you know, generally not going to put you over the edge, or at least it's hard to project that it will put you over the edge. So we make a big deal about every signing and addition. We break it down 10 different ways because it's the winter and what else are we going to do? But, you know, it always is a bit of a downer for me when we go from the playoffs to talking about transactions, because it just seems so insignificant compared to when you're watching the World Series and every single hit is changing the championship probability of the season a meaningful amount. And then, you know, you're talking about the biggest move of the winter maybe budges one team's World Series odds by a couple percentage points or something like that. And it just all seems so insignificant by comparison.
You're absolutely right. And that the takeaway from that deadline research, which Cliff Corcoran and I did, and this is just a slight exaggeration to say that the only meaningful trade ever within a season was Lou Brock for Ernie Broglio, and everything else is just kind of, yeah. You know, so, I mean, or at least there's smaller, much smaller impacts than, you know, a guy joining your team and hitting 350 for the rest of the season and stealing a bunch of bases. Ben, I greatly appreciate your saving my bacon again. I am loath to keep you a second longer because I know you have podcasts of your own. What teams are coming up for the next Effectively Wild preview episode?
Dodgers and Marlins. Quite a pairing.
Talking about the Titanic team up that you demanded.
Yeah, we're going in order of projection. So we're doing like the best projected teams, pairing them with the worst projected teams, and then eventually we'll meet in the middle right around opening day. So this way we get a good team to go with a bad team every time, although the Marlins are at least interesting in their own way.
So I'm imagining that for the Dodgers, you got some noted writer who covers the Dodgers, and that for the Marlins, you just have a sad trombone sound.
Yeah, they've traded all the writers that we would have had on. They let go of the guy who was their mascot or something. So it's filtered all the way down to that. And not that they had a huge press corps covering them at any time, but particularly now, it's a strange beat to be on because it's almost less about baseball than it is about, I don't know, reading Jeffrey Loria's fine print or something.
You should not read Jeffrey Loria's fine print. You should do the Andy Kaufman thing and just every game, instead of doing the play by play, just read a chapter of The Great Gatsby over the over the air.
Sure. Yeah. There's not that many people paying attention, probably. We actually had a real life Marlins fan on the podcast this winter just to document his existence and find out why he remains a Marlins fan after all this time. And it seemed like his loyalty was just unshakable, even after the trading of almost everyone who was interesting on the team.
He must be like the last passenger pigeon. You know, there are pictures of the I think the last one died in a zoo in Cincinnati in 1916. And there are pictures of this animal that must be the loneliest damn thing. It could literally make you cry. And and I mean, that guy, I mean, then again, he can turn on any national broadcast and see that dude who sits behind the plate, right? So he knows there's at least one more if they can just find each other and mate.
That's true. Well, that's one way to end this.
Well, the real way to end it is to say brush up on that question on rectal health, because the next time in trouble, I'll be revisiting that with you. So be better prepared next time. Thanks again.
I will be. My pleasure. Thank you.
By Oscar Wilde's most cutting remark, we have reached the end of another show. You can follow Ben Lindbergh on Twitter at Ben Lindbergh. It makes sense, right? If you had a store selling Ben Lindberghs, you'd call it the Ben Lindbergh store. And you can follow me at Go Stephen Goldman. Why Go Stephen Goldman? Because Go Long Stephen Goldman implies an ability to catch footballs that I do not actually possess. You can also write us at infiniteinning@gmail.com and rate us, by which I mean me. And who goes around crying, rate me? I mean, this is not a dating app. Anyway, rate us at the podcatcher of your choice. It is greatly appreciated. We have a sponsor now, but nonetheless, this episode is brought to you by the number 35. Our producer is Deco Modern. Our theme song, which you are hearing now and have been hearing throughout the episode, was co-authored by myself and Dr. Richard Mooring, who we talked about extensively earlier in the episode. You know, when we were talking about sidekicks and the Breakfast Club, I was reaching for the words Judd Nelson, but what my brain kept sending me was Judd Hirsch, which is a very different thing. And in any case, neither really applies to Rick, who was more of an Emilio Estevez. If Emilio Estevez had a huge brain, it's hard to figure out. Well, if I don't get hired to write a revival of the Uncle Wiggily series and get carpal tunnel syndrome typing the word rheumatism over and over again, I'll be back actually later this week with more tales and discussion from inside the Infinite Inning.